Let me start by asking both of you whether there was anything that I sort of outlined that came as a surprise to you in our community poll survey.
Oh, thank you. Nothing surprised me about that, Melinda. I was really delighted that CEDA had done the work and that you've been around the country talking about this and that you took this data to Canberra. I think it tells a story that we've been pretending or trying not to hear for quite a long time. And those of us that are fortunate enough to be in the beneficiary category of the economy and sit on boards and can look at the economy from a particular perspective, if we're not aware of this, then there's no way that our politicians and elected representatives are aware of it. And so I think it's incredible timing to be doing this today, because we're talking about a leadership challenge which goes far beyond, I think, just the Prime Minister, but a complete disconnect between the lived experience of many Australians and where policy sits and where we actually define what economic growth has really meant. So what it highlighted for me was that we, at some point in that 26 years of uninterrupted growth, which we champion all over the world about our great success, we left out the word inclusive and the word sustainable. So that growth has come at a great cost to a number of people. And your survey, I think, unpacks that. And it's totally consistent with the work of the Centre for Policy Development. It's done exactly the same kind of analysis about where do people think policy focus should be when they're asked similar questions. And their view is exactly the same. It's not about tax cuts for big business. It's not about looking after those that already have wealth. It's really about those critical issues to do with how people really do live day to day, even if they've got a good job. They're worried about health, as you've pointed out, particularly the public health system. They're worried about the public education system, not the private, as you've pointed out. More and more people are very worried about the environment, although they use language that maybe talks about the Great Barrier Reef, or in your survey, the national parks issue, as I think a proxy for where we're losing something that we can't quite put our finger on, and our children will live in a world that doesn't have quite the same degree of natural environment benefits that we've enjoyed. And it felt very truth-telling exercise, and made me think that we live in a world where our elected representatives can't tell a story about what our nation is really about. And they seem terrified to actually tell that story with its complexity and its bits and pieces that actually would include us all and then engage in the policy discussion about how we get a more inclusive and less divisive political and governance system. I'm happy to talk more about what my boards and others see, but I think you're to be congratulated for doing this. And because it's CEDA, you can carry great weight with people who need to understand that there's not a flaw in your system. This is what you've described in your survey is the world that I see in almost every part of the economy. And so we can talk a bit more about what we do, but all totally consistent.
Thanks, Melinda. Firstly, congratulations to CEDA on the work. I think it's really important work. I think it, as Sam says, it reflects something that everybody's kind of known about, but not everybody's been talking about, and so it will be an important tool in the ongoing conversation. To your question, was there anything there that surprised me? I wasn't surprised by anything in the headline things that you showed. I did find a couple of things, though, surprising when I was looking at the more detailed material on the table. I was surprised by some of the things that are turning up in the not important category. There's a few indicators down there around the future of employment, about job mobility, about education pathways, which I thought might have been more important to people. And the other thing I found interesting rather than surprising is the pretty strong alignment right across Australia between different states in terms of their responses. And you mentioned at our table that alignment flows through to intergenerational alignment and alignment between metropolitan and regional areas, which, I do find that surprising. I find that on a number of the issues you've identified, that the generational gap isn't a bigger gap, but in terms of the absolute headlines, I think it's what you've identified is, as Sam says, is real and truthful.
It's the point about the unimportant stuff is really interesting one actually, and I'll just take 2 seconds. One of the things that we tried to do when we've been talking to different audiences was to summarise a takeout for different groups, if you like. And for government, I've presented this data to Prime Minister and Cabinet twice now in different forums. And my message to people in government was a very direct and simple one. Know that what you do matters to people, right? The services that you provide or regulate really, really matter to people. So don't spend your day thinking that what you do is unimportant, but you need to do it better. And you're going to have to figure out how you engage with the community and how you engage with business and how you actually start being more transparent. So that was my message to government. My message to business was pretty simple. People think you've benefited enormously and people don't support the things that are necessary to keep you competitive. So in shorthand, my message to business people has been, I think instead of trying to tell the community why you are important to them, you need to turn the lens around and actually explain to the community why they are important to you. And start behaving in a way which shows that you're listening to the things that matter to them and responding. And not surprisingly, there's a transparency message in there as well. But just on this point about in the bottom and in some of the questions on work, there were some, we were actually really trying to unpack how are people feeling about these conversations around job security, around technology, how things might change in the future, this ability to move, the ability to gain skills throughout your lifetime also was seen as relatively unimportant. And so when I look through it, one of the things I presented at a TAFE conference the other day, and one of the things I said was, what's happening, what seems to come through the survey on that front is that people are still very worried about that transition from school into work. So they're very worried about jobs for young people. They're worried about school and things like that. But that focus on lifelong learning is actually not there. And it seems to me that there's a risk that from an individual perspective, people are a bit complacent about what skills they're going to need to develop and how they're going to engage and work in the future. And so I think that's a little bit of a call out if I think of, well, what, as an individual, what's one of the takeouts? Yes, sure.
Sorry. I think you're absolutely right. I think some of us get to a certain age where we think it's not going to affect us. And I'd love to see the survey done around a cohort of young people at university, at their higher end of high school. And if you look at the work done most recently by the Foundation for Young Australians, that makes the point that our education system is completely inadequate in preparing that cohort of Australian students for the kind of work that you're describing. Mm. So those young people do know that they'll have a career that may have five or six sectors in it. It may be a stint in entrepreneurial life, it may be in government, it may be in a small business, it may be some time in academia. But that cohort understands that they are not going to be in a job for life or even a job that you might change every 10 years. But the system doesn't support them to be ready for that. And good employers kind of know that and are getting the cream of the crop. So if you're lucky enough to have your children picked up as an internship in a really big, well-run company that's rethinking this whole notion of licence to operate, which you described, then they're going to be actually much better off than everybody else. And I can say that from the companies I'm involved with. I think the young people get into Mirvac and Transurban and Virgin are actually going to do incredibly well because those companies and big companies generally have worked out that they do actually have to provide that kind of training and opportunity for younger people. But if you're a kid growing up outside privilege and you're just getting a normal HSC and you barely get into university or get a debt where you want to do a trade and you think that's going to be okay, then you're in desperate trouble and you know it. You've got hex debts, you've got issues about where you're going to live, so that's why you stay at home for as long as you do. And the FIA research shows that if we don't radically change the opportunity for those young people, then we'll have a skills issue, we'll have an unemployment issue. And it takes us to describing how long it's going to take us to have the right storytelling around our unemployment figures. So our unemployment figures hide underemployment and the patchwork economy that people are just holding together just to get enough money to get through the week, and yet they're not in the unemployment figures. So back to storytelling, you know, we need policymakers who are prepared to actually speak about what it's like to be putting that patchwork career together, and that by not dealing with living wage issues and the new start kind of costs, we're letting a whole generation down. I think people do worry about that for their children, less for themselves.
Yeah. So both of you have business backgrounds. Both been involved in policy, wearing business hats as well. From that frame, you know, how do you interpret these results, and how do you, you know, think about the role of business in responding to the issues that are coming out? And in your various capacities, how do you think about, you know, driving a business response or getting business to look and behave differently, I guess?
Well, one way I interpret the results is the way that you interpreted them, which is that there's been a layer below which none of the benefits of growth have travelled. So that there's a kind of horizontal divide between those who have benefited from growth and those that haven't. The other thing we know from all the work we do around Sydney, and you can replicate this work in the other cities of Australia, is there's a spatial divide. So inequity in our society is spatially defined. We've allowed Australian society to turn in to become a low-density urban society where most people do not have great access to amenity and services and opportunity. So we've created these two, like a vertical and a horizontal division in the benefits of growth. At the same time, we have a very highly visible and highly publicised sort of corporate community, which gets reported on a lot, gets a lot of scrutiny, has, I think, in a good way, been pushing further and further into policy and social issues over the last few years, that thinks it's doing a good job in leadership on issues like the kinds of issues that you're identifying, but hasn't recognised those two divides, hasn't recognised that beyond the field of its sort of own reach are groups of people who do not see what they are doing, do not see any of the benefits of the activities that they're involved in, and are, essentially feeling like the last 25 years has passed them by. So I think business just hasn't spotted how big that gap is, and that it's a spatial gap, and that it's an income gap.
I think this is an incredibly important moment for business, and mainly the sort of medium to big business, but it applies elsewhere. It worries me that these conversations are often binary. So if you ask people about who represents business, they'll talk about the BCA. They might talk about the BCA campaign on tax reform, and they'll talk about the fact that so few chief executives step up and actually have a social conscience discussion with the community, and those that do are then told they should stick to the knitting of making money for their shareholders. So we've seen that through the marriage equality debate. You see it in climate change and climate policy. You see it with inequality discussions. So I think what business, exactly to your point, Michael, about most big businesses I'm involved with do think they're doing a pretty good job on the license to operate. But if you unpack it, they haven't actually fully understood how their businesses do affect the inequality discussion. They feel very nervous entering into the policy debate. I think they're very cautious about giving support to the public service. There's this kind of let's get rid of the public service and bureaucrats. There's a sort of general lack of engagement between business and other parts of the economy that should be dealt with collaboratively. I think we lack collaboration skills in business. We tend to think we sit at the top of the tree in business and can help others. We criticise government, and then we get out there with campaigns where business sort of hides behind an industry association, which I think is incredibly dangerous because you lose all of the great stories and observations you can make within a business about what you can do better. I think the Sustainable Development Goals are a great example of where really great businesses are stepping up and saying, if we're to meet the SDGs, for a better, more sustainable, inclusive capitalist system to be maintained, we're going to have to work together on a whole lot of policy issues and really put ourselves at some risk doing that. And our SDG performance as a country, which will be at a coming CEDA event where the National Sustainability Council will report, shows that we've done worse on inequality on all of the measures in the SDGs in the last few years. So we do quite well on lots of things, but on inequality and economic outcomes for all, we are very, very poor and going backwards. So business, I think, works on the basis that's not a real problem. If you take it at the aggregated level, I think we need to see leadership in business stepping up and saying, what will it take to meet the SDGs? What does partnership and collaboration look like? And actually start talking to shareholders about what does sort of lower returns look like What would that feel like for all of us as superannuants and others, and have that really brave conversation rather than always about shareholder growth, shareholder value, and in that trap of economic growth has no bounds? There's a price to our economic growth.
So a sustainable rate of return?
A sustainable rate of return that's, that doesn't leave us without an environment, doesn't leave us without good social outcomes, doesn't leave us without an uneducated young cohort. I always talk about paying full freight. I mean, I think our economy has not paid full freight for the things that gave us that great 26-year period of growth. It has come at a cost, a human cost for some, an environmental cost, an energy cost, and a policy cost. And I think for business to be taken seriously again, we've got to have leaders stepping up and engaging honestly in that debate and not assume they've got all the answers. So back to collaboration and really understanding the CEDA work. We've got to work at the city level, the regional level. And I think we've got to just get a bit of humanity into our, it's the way business speaks with the community rather than at and to the community as the great drivers of benefits.
Yeah, I think it's a challenging time, and you're right to sort of highlight, some of the good examples that exist in terms of collaboration. And we've had the benefit of hearing from Lendlease on the CEDA stage, talking about the work that they've done in Bourke in New South Wales, where essentially having business involved with that community has enabled them to develop a relationship with the state government in a way that's transformed the services delivered in that community. And, one of the things that that having a business partner did was put pressure on the government, the New South Wales government, and I give them full credit for responding to this, to actually provide data to the community about how much was being spent. So Bourke has a significant Aboriginal population. They were spending an enormous amount of money. There were 60-odd services being delivered into the community and literally millions and millions of dollars for very poor outcomes, effectively. Because the community didn't have access to that information, they were always on an uneven playing field in terms of negotiating with government around what programs might be better. So I think there are tremendous examples of collaboration, which leads me to my question, which is the intention of doing the survey wasn't to sort of be doom and gloom. It really is to try to get us to think about, what next. And we were talking at lunch about if you ask someone, what does economic development mean for a country like Bangladesh, you would get a pretty clear response. Economic development means your kids don't die, that you've got access to basic services, life gets better. And I think that question about what is economic development as the Committee for Economic Development of Australia, what does that look like in the future, is really why we're doing this work. And so that's my question to the two of you. What's your vision for what economic development looks like, or, how we get to a place of genuine progress, however you want to define that?
I think one thing that your data also shows is that the things that matter to people a lot are very often the things which are very immediate and very local and that affect their lives on a daily basis. I could get sick tomorrow. I could lose my job tomorrow. I have to get to work tomorrow. People really focus on the stuff that is important to them. And at the Committee for Sydney, one of the ways we think about this is that really what people want is they want to be happy in a place. They want to feel that they are living a good life in a good place. And a good place means a city or a town that has high amenity, that has a genuine community, that is a good place to be, a place where their children can afford to live near them, a place where they can get to work without spending 3 hours a day in their car, a place where they can be healthy, and a place where they feel secure about the future. I think that is probably a lot of people's idea of prosperity. I think when you look at what people are worried about and what they're thinking about, it is that some of those elements are not turning up in the places where people live. So what do you do about that? I think another reason why people might think that a lot of these things are passing them by is something that Sam mentioned before, the sort of binary nature of much of the debate, which is it's business versus the community, which kind of ignores the fact that the community is employed by business and are shareholders of business and, you know, engage with business as customers all the time. But there's that kind of, you know, dichotomy always talked about. It's city versus the country when regions can't prosper without cities and cities can't prosper without regions. So there's this kind of, there's a lack of a cohesive narrative which connects up a lot of these things that people are worried about. I mean, it's really odd to me that people are worried about commuting times and worried about health. Sorry, they're worried a lot about health, but they're not so worried about commuting times and not worried about access to parks and recreation facilities. And yet, you know, we know that those two things are intimately connected, that that long-term health and avoiding chronic illness in an urban environment is really connected to how long you spend in your car, how walkable your neighbourhood is, how many trees are in your street. All these things matter. And yet, I don't think business or government are doing enough together to emphasise some of the connections between these things and to emphasise not that they produce economic prosperity, but that they produce well-being for people who are in a place. Mm. So to me, it keeps coming back to happiness in a place. And interestingly, there are some countries in the world that have adopted those measures for their government. Costa Rica is one, Bhutan is one. They don't rate very highly economically compared to Australia, but they're generally pretty happy places, I think.
I have to say I've struggled when I've done policy work when someone says to you, and where has this policy been rolled out? And the countries include Costa Rica and Bhutan. But anyway.
Yeah. I'm going to take you at your word about a vision, because I think this is, again, where our elected representatives have just completely failed us. And I'd like to see that Australia could actually stop looking back and harking for a time that was comfortable and easier and less stressful, and actually have a plausible vision of the future, which is actually borne out by your most important issues on the survey. But it starts for me with the notion of being one of the most inclusive nations in the world. We have been a generous recipient of migrants and refugees, and we've had a toxic debate in the last couple of weeks about a return to the White Australia policy. And it was wonderful to see so many Australians saying, that is not us. So turn that around. What is us? You know, we want to be an inclusive, diverse, generous nation that harnesses the full power of everyone who chooses to be here and is lucky enough to be born here. And just stating the obvious about the contribution that's made through diversity, but through real inclusion, right across not just big business, but small business, our education sectors, our public policymakers, to actually state that with a great, not some sort of political statement, but what does that then look like? And it means it's got to be a place that's safe for people who are different. We should have one of the most safe places for women and girls in the world if we really do care about the issue that came up about violence against women. Why is it that we have some of the worst violence against women statistics in this country? We haven't invested in a discussion about why Australia could be one of the greatest places for opportunity for girls and women from around the world. More people do want to know what an environment looks like with renewable energy, and could Australia lead the world on the transition from heavy dependence on fossil fuels to a clean economy and make money out of it, talk about it in economic terms, and actually say that's an ambition the country has, is to be a clean, green country that can do things even bigger than New Zealand with its clean economy type of thinking. Our food systems, our agricultural systems could be leading the world when it comes to thinking about pressure on food services, food sources. We have some of those pristine environments. We have the oldest living culture, continuous culture in the world. We talk about Indigenous issues. We give Indigenous gifts to invited visiting people. We talk about RAPs and a lasting reconciliation with Indigenous peoples, but our political leaders dispute and throw away the offer of the Uluru Statement, which is actually to try to repair 200 years of keeping First Nations people at bay. So, you know, part of my vision of Australia is that we actually have reached a lasting and respectful relationship with First Nations peoples. They do have a voice in the parliament, and we cherish that as part of our ability to deal with inclusion and diversity, and we never walk away from that all being part of what builds a great economy. and that we don't say that all has to be done in some kind of socialist utopia. It's actually underpinned by a strong economy with great jobs, and where people do fall through the system, our public system supports them. So we remain strong on our public education, our public health, and it reflects what people have said in the survey. And there's great business to be made in all of that. There's great economic development. And we know that people don't want to see this all coming just from the parliamentary process and believe in our democracy. So the last thing I say is CPD, when it looked at what did people want out of our democracy, said something very simple. Classic four-year terms for parliamentarians to stop this nonsense that we're going through today. A federal ICAC to hold people to account on bad behaviour. Parliamentary diversity, so that our parliaments represent us, and a code of conduct for everybody in our parliaments. Embedding the public sector in more of Australia, so not cutting public sector services, not cutting public servants, and public agencies' independence, and underpinning all of that, a really strong view about what a great Australia would look like if we harnessed our full diversity. You know, that's a really... I want to live in that country, and I feel really proud of it, and that's the story I hear from young people who are actually rejecting a whole lot of the negative stuff and are jumping in and creating their own businesses, their own social impact businesses, working for philanthropists to do this and believe that that's the best way they can spend their time as great Australians. But, you know.
So we're just going to run a leadership spill right here, right now. If you get more than 35 votes, you're in. No.
can I just pick up on something Sam just said about that we've been a tolerant, welcoming, diverse and inclusive society. We will publish at the end of this month a global benchmark survey, looks at 400 global surveys and ranks Sydney within those 400 surveys. The reason we do so well in global surveys is for what you just talked about. People see that about our society as the most attractive thing that we have, and they see it whether they're tourists, whether they're business people wanting to invest, whether they're students who want to come and study here. They are the things that people grab hold to in terms of Australian society. I think the thing that Australians have always prided themselves on, in addition to those things, is a degree of equality which has been unusual in the developed world, or a degree of equity. And it's interesting if you sit down, it tells you how dull my bedside reading is, but if you sit down with the UN development indices and the UN global Gini coefficient indices and look at relative inequality across the world, and you look at surveys of happiness across the world, what you see, and this is widely understood, is that more unequal societies are more unhappy societies, and the unhappiness is about the only thing that gets equally distributed. That the richest people in unequal societies are very unhappy, just as the poorest people are. And I wonder sometimes whether some of the crisis in public confidence in Australia and some of the trust crisis that I'm sure everyone in this room has spent a long time hearing about comes from a sense that we've allowed that stretch just to get a little too big in Australia, and no one's comfortable with it, top or bottom.
Yeah, no, just on that was confirmed by our survey where, you know, roughly 80% of people were saying that the gap between the richest and poorest in Australia was unacceptable. And the interesting thing too was that, you know, obviously you can look at that through different income cohorts, but even top income earners, you know, roughly 70% of top income earners were saying that it's unacceptable as well.